Hey, this is Misty Lee.
And this is Paul Dini.
And back with us again?
I'm still here. Mark Evanier.
And this time I'm going to try to get the conversation over into my realm. And let's talk about magic a little bit.
Gladly.
Okay, Mark, what's your Carl Valentine story?
I decided I can't tell that story on the air.
Oh, no. Well, we didn't talk very much about this last time because you guys talked mostly cartoons. As you are both want to do. Oh, let me ask you this first before we get on to magic, though, because that was a very clumsy transition into magic. But before we go, who's your favorite Bugs?
Bugs Bunny?
Mm-hmm. Which one? Which, do you like McKimson's Bugs? Do you like, whose Bugs do you like?
I tell you, I can't. I'm a Chuck Jones Bugs Bunny guy. Okay. I know there are animators who will tell me that this is not good cartoon making, but I never laughed more than I laughed at Duck, Rabbit Duck, and Seasoning, and Rabbit, I think it's Rabbit Fire, that's the trilogy of that stuff with Daffy, and I mean, it's not, I know people don't like it because it's talking jokes, it's not physical, visual, and I understand that, and I agree that it's much better when I like the Chuck Jones Bugs probably the best, which is not to say I don't love every Bugs for some reason.
That's fair. I just wanted to know.
All right.
I don't think I knew.
Wile
E.
Coyote speaking or non-speaking?
Non-speaking.
Oh really?
Okay. Yes.
No, Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
I love it.
I wrote the Roadrunner comic book. He not only talked. The Roadrunners talked in rhyme.
Yeah. Oh.
And I always felt that was wrong. I mean, I was doing it, but...
The Roadrunner's the demon Etrigan?
So it wasn't your idea to have him speak like that? It was just
no, I don't know if it was Michael Maltese's, who he wrote the comic books. They used to think that the comic books had to be kind of a separate entity of the cartoons. That attitude went away over the years. But you got to remember that in the 50s, when kids were buying the comic books, they weren't seeing Bugs Bunny on TV every week. They were seeing one Bugs Bunny short every couple months at a movie theater.
Right.
So it didn't matter if the cartoons matched the comic books that closely. And that's why in the newspaper strip, the Bugs Bunny newspaper strip for years, Sylvester talked with an English accent.
Yeah, I remember. I was just going to mention that. Yeah. Sylvester was actually kind of the star of it, and he was always going around, I say, Governor, you know, like he was...
You know, cheerio, old bean.
Yeah.
Really?
And, yeah, they and nobody cared at that point.
Yeah.
The comic book was a separate entity. Even when the comic book was written by the same guy writing the animated cartoon, it was a totally different take on the characters.
Yeah, the model on Daffy was kind of a McKimson-ish Daffy, but he was also... He wasn't the Chuck Jones Daffy. He was just his own thing. And Yosemite Sam was always the pirate model. He wasn't the cowboy.
Yeah.
And they were just like its own weird thing.
Hmm.
But, well.
Okay, so since you won't tell your Valentine story as a transition into magic, I'll tell mine. I think I told you this the other day, but the people at home haven't heard it yet.
Right.
And I'll keep it very brief. So Mark Nelson, who's a mutual friend of all of ours, had written a script for Carl Ballantyne to present at the annual Magic Castle Awards, and Carl and I were slated to present the Comedy Magician of the Year Award. And what the joke was I was just to wear a corset and show up in a very tight-fitting dress because Carl was going to come out and start reading the scripts and say, I can't see this without my specs. And he would say, specs? And I was to come on the stage to kettle drum da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da music, and he would say, 36, 24, 36, those are my specs. Here you go, specs, read this, tell him what it says. That was the joke. Mm-hmm. So we're sitting backstage, and first of all, I learned from a master what it's like to manipulate an audience, because he had several more jokes than that. And as we were, I was very nervous. I was, we had to take a look at the script. And Carl's like, yeah, I saw it. And I said, you don't want to memorize it? You don't. He goes, I got what I need. I said, okay, wow. So we're sitting backstage, and he's listening. And I was trying to talk to him, oh, Mr. Ballantyne, it's such a delight to be around you. And he's going, yeah, hang on just one second. And he was very gracious, but he just put his finger up. And he was listening to the audience. And he goes, okay, I got him. I said, what do you mean you got him? And he goes, well, I wanted to hear what they were laughing at. And he was listening to the speech being given by the person in front of us. And when it was time for us to go on stage, he said, give me that script that you had in your hand. And I handed it to him, and he crumpled it up, and he threw it aside. And he said, they're not going to laugh at this. Go get me a spoon. And I said, okay. And so I went and got the guy a spoon, and he came out and did one of his tried and true routines, and he killed with it. And the only joke he kept was the specs joke. And I said, why did you do that? I couldn't believe he wasn't in trouble, you know, because I was so green and so new and didn't really know that this was freaking Carl Ballantyne. Mm-hmm. But he said, look, kid, he said, I was on a circuit for an awful long time. And once your audience tells you what they want to hear by laughing, you give them more. And he said, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, that's Carl Ballantyne. Those guys are all wonderful. With the few we have left,
yeah,
we have to hold on to. We lost Carl last year, a year before. Mm-hmm. And he was just wonderful. He started working on Garfield. I wanted to have a recurring con man character on the show.
Oh, perfect.
I decided to have a recurring con man character on the show. So I somebody who would like pop up the way Frank Nelson did in the old Jack Benny mm-hmm. show. Every mm-hmm. place we go, this guy would be trying to sell Garfield yeah. his own or something.
Awesome.
So I wrote this episode, and I cast in the role a man named Jesse White, who was a very wonderful character actor in his day.
Uh-huh.
And Jesse White came in, and I realized, unfortunately, we were a few years too late to get Jesse. He was not in good shape. He passed away about a year later, but he was just
the Maytag man, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was the Maytag man. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and I loved him on Stan Freberg Presents the United States of America, Volume 1, where he played King Ferdinand and a few other roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was the guy who always played an agent on camera
yeah.
roles,
yeah.
things like that.
FYI, and I love Stan Freberg. I just want to get
and,
that out
And
there.
He just was not Jesse anymore.
Oh, okay.
That's a shame.
So we did the episode. We recorded the episode. It wasn't that successful. And I walked out into the lobby afterwards, and I think to myself, well, I can't bring this character back. I can't have him again.
Mm-hmm.
I got to find someone else to play a con man character. I walked into the lobby, and so helped me. Sitting there waiting to record something in the other studio joining us was Carl Ballantyne.
Of course.
And I went, thank you.
And yes.
I had seen Carl Ballantyne in the best evening I ever spent in the theater in my life was the second night of a new production that was done down at the Amundsen Theater in 1970-71 of A Funny Thing Happened Away the Forum with Phil Silvers.
Oh my God.
Wow. Right.
And Come on.
The cast was Phil Silvers was playing Pseudolus, Carl Ballantyne was playing Marcus Lycus.
Oh, wonderful.
Lou Parker, who people remember as playing Marlo Thomas's father and that girl,
was
Senex. Larry Blyden was playing Hysterium.
Ooh.
Anne
what?
Gillian was one of the courtesans.
Oh,
what?
Excellent.
The tall courtesan. Gymnasia was played by a Broadway actress named Charlene Ryan, who is now married to Sergio Aragonés.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And the whole company was just a wonderful, wonderful production.
Wow.
And I never laughed so hard in my life. I had a better, we who love musical theater, we're like junkies trying to recapture that great high.
Yeah. Yes.
And we go to the shows hoping it'll be like that.
Yeah.
Well, when you saw Phil Silvers and Carl Ballantyne on stage, uh-huh. you had the absolute pinnacle of guys who know comedy timing
yeah.
and vaudeville style delivery. And I just loved that whole production. And so when I saw Carl Ballantyne sitting there, I went, you know, I ran over to him, introduced myself, and I said, I want you to do a Garfield next week.
Mm-hmm.
And I rewrote I wrote a new con man character. I gave him a new name. I actually wanted to go back and redo the one with Jesse, but they needed the production too fast.
Oh, okay. Mm.
I couldn't do that with him, but I created a new con man character, and he was in about 8 episodes, and he was wonderful, and he was Ballantyne. He'd come in, and you know, he just had a comfort level. An old pro knows exactly how to get every laugh that's on the page, and then some.
I mean, he was such a natural in McHale's Navy. I loved him as Gruber, you know, and he was the fast talking con man of the group, and it's terrific.
Yeah, but when people ask you sometimes, how do you cast a show? You have moments like that.
Yeah, there you go. I had one other thing happen that same night that I was talking about. We were backstage, and Chris Angel was getting the Magician of the Year award. And Carl
did,
and I...
Did they edit him in the middle of the speech?
Yeah, well, yeah. He just appeared at the podium. Yeah, but we're, you know, Carl and I are backstage sharing a dressing room, and we're talking about racehorsing. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who don't know who Carl was, first of all, he's a brilliant magician, and you need to look up his act on YouTube, because he's hysterical. But also, he loved himself the ponies so much that he named his daughters... Go ahead, Mark.
His daughters are all named after racetracks.
Yes.
Oh, my.
He's got a daughter, Sarah, but it's not Sarah, it's Saratoga.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, really. And they're great names, you know. Yes. But what are his other two daughters' names?
What, Delmar and...
Hialeah. I don't know. I don't know if that was
Pimlico or...
Santa Anita. I have no idea.
Okay. Well, yeah. I'll ask Sarah.
I just know Sarah.
Mm-hmm. But we were sitting backstage and we were sharing a green room because we were already dressed, clearly. You know, you come to this thing ready to go.
Right.
And we were just bonding. And he was saying, oh, God, I'll take you down and show you. Let me show you how I pick things. I have no idea what I'm doing. And, you know, like I said, okay. But we were having a great time. And while we were in there, Chris Angel walked in. And now Chris had his own dressing room. He didn't really need to be in ours. But I think he kind of just wanted to meet Carl, but he was awkward and he didn't know what to do. So instead of, you know, coming in and saying, hello, my name is Chris. I admire you very much. He came in. And very, you know, sort of self-aware and very unusual and awkwardly walked to the mirror in the back of the room and go, oh, and he said, oh, excuse me, I just want to see how stupid I look. And he left and Carl looked at me very flatly and said, he has no idea how stupid he looks.
Did he even say anything to Ballantyne? Like,
no, he didn't address either one of us. It was just I really think that it was, and I don't know Chris Angel at all.
Yeah.
And I think that he's done a lot for marketing of magic and he's brought it into the awareness and he kind of filled that gap between Copperfield 1 and Copperfield 2, who's on his way back.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, he was very, very nervous. And I think he genuinely admired Carl because he's been kind of a magic nerd his whole life. Chris Angel, meaning. And I think he just kind of didn't know what to say.
Uh-huh.
But he just kind of came in and douchebagged it up and took off. And Carl was just like, and he said he has no idea how stupid he looks. So anyways, and he just went on with what he was saying. And I just thought, man, to have seen him in both of those capacities, in repose, you know, when he's just watching and just that seeing that acerbic wit pop out.
Yeah.
But B, having the opportunity to hear a pro read an audience and pulls something out of his repertoire of material that's tried and true, that he knew, tested tried and true, that he knew full well he was going to knock him on the floor with.
Yeah.
And see how he went through that process. I spent one night with him, and I felt like I had studied with him my whole life.
Yeah. You meet guys like that in comedy who are just, they've done it forever, and it just radiates out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was a tremendous gift.
Carl Reiner, I presume, is like that?
Carl Reiner is amazing.
Uh-huh.
Carl Reiner is so brilliant, just and one of the nicest human beings on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, man has spent his life making other people look good. He made Sid Caesar look good. Then he made Dick Van Dyke look good. Then he made Mel Brooks look good. Mm-hmm. Then he made these movies. He made Steve Martin look good.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, nobody's had a more successful career than Carl, making other people look good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so now I want to talk magic with you.
Okay.
Mark is an historian of magic at the Magic Castle. Officially so, they even gave him a little gold pin that says so. Okay. And he had to audition for that. What was your audition? What did you have to do?
I just had to tell him the history of magic and stuff like that. And,
you had to recite Milburn Christopher's book.
And I did a card trick, so, you know.
You did a card trick too?
I did a card trick, yes.
Anyway. Mark did a card trick for us the other day at the Magic Castle, and it was very good.
Thank you.
I have to say. Mm-hmm. I have to say. So you went in and they asked you magic history questions? Was it like a trivia?
I was an associate member for a while, and then some people at the castle thought I should be upgraded to a magician member.
And you should.
I didn't want to do a full magic audition because I don't like doing that stuff.
Yeah.
And they said, just come in and prove us you're a historian. I went in and I told them enough anecdotes they hadn't heard that they were happy about that.
Nice. Okay. And now what kind of magic do you love?
Kind of magic I love? Well, I love smart magic. I love magic. I love either somebody taking a classic trick and taking it to a new level, the way like Johnny Ace Palmer does the cups and balls like no one else has done the cups and balls.
Indeed.
Or I like someone who comes out there and just gives you something you've never seen before, some sort of a skill. I love people who do things with great skill. There's a beauty to someone doing something really well, no matter what it is.
Mm-hmm.
One of my good friends is not a magician, but is a juggler named Charlie Fry in
Yes.
Vegas. And when you see Charlie juggle, you're seeing a guy who's been doing it for 35 years, three shows a night. He's got every single move down. He knows how to do every... It's like Baryshnikov doing a fine ballet.
Mm-hmm.
There's an art to it. And you know, then I feel the same way when I see... You know, Whit Hayden doing card tricks at the castle, or Richard Turner,
are the one who introduced me to Richard Turner.
Right.
You changed my life. Will you tell them who Richard Turner
Richard
is?
Richard Turner, one night, I used to take back when all my friends who were comic writers lived on the East Coast, they'd come out for the Comic Con. We go. I take them all to the Magic Castle. And one night I took about five comic book writers to the Magic Castle, and we walked into this room, and this man came out and did card tricks by touch because he was blind. And we said, my God, we found Daredevil. Everyone in our group had written Daredevil at one point or another.
Yeah.
I had just written a Daredevil animated pilot that never sold. But Steve Gerber was with us, and Len Wein was with us, and Mark Wolfman was with us. We'd all written Daredevil
at some
point.
That's a hell of a group of dudes.
And we saw this guy who was, they would put a card in his hand, and he would tell you whether it was an ace or a face card, because the face cards have more ink on them and way more.
Mm.
You could tell by the touch, and that's scary. I mean, that's magic on a whole different level, and Richard Turner does that, and he's become more blind. He was legally blind, and now he's almost totally blind, and he can still do these amazing card tricks, but he can't tell for sure if the cards are face up or face down.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes his tricks get screwed up because the cards are face. He thinks they're face up or face down, but the trick would work if the cards were all facing the right way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, and
but I've seen this guy. I mean, he is one of the few people in the world who can deal the third card from the top flawlessly.
Yeah, and all it took was practicing 12 hours a day for 40 years.
What is it? He says he has a three-pack
three a day. Three-pack a day habit. Three packs of cards a day, yeah. I'll tell you a story about the cast. I don't know if I ever did. Did I ever tell you the Cuddlebuck story?
No.
All right, I'll tell you a story. This is a creepy story. I'll warn you in advance. All right. In the 50s, there was a man named Cuddlebuck who was billed on TV as the man with X-ray eyes. And his act basically, he did all sorts of different kind of magic, but his specialty was that they would blindfold him with 23 layers of dough and tape and metal things, and they'd put coins over his eyes, and then he would drive a car or he would do something.
Wow. Of course, because that's safe.
And he had other kinds of things. He was kind of, and he had a TV show. He had a weekly TV show on television for a while, and he was popped up on guests a lot in other shows. Hmm. He was kind of as big as Chris Angel in his own way. But this is like the late 50s. And he retired. So I'm at the castle one night. It was a Monday night. It was not very busy. I took up a friend of mine, a cartoonist friend who was staying with me at the time, a lady named Sherry Flanagan. People remember Sherry from doing Trots and Bonnie on the National Lampoon. Mm-hmm. And we go to this big room. We go to this room. We go to that room. As we're leaving, one of the hosts says to me, "You're not leaving before the special show, are you?" And I said, "What special show?" And he said, "Oh, we're having one performance only tonight. Cuddlebuck is doing his act. He's coming out of retirement for one night to do his act for magicians. We can squeeze you in." I go, "Okay." Sherry was real tired. I said, "Please, we've got to stay for one with this." It was like an 11 o'clock show he was doing, because they were waiting until the castle kind of cleared out to do this. So we went into the parlor of prestidigitation, and Sherry and I were the only people in there who were not accomplished magicians. It was all the top magicians from the castle, all the people that you admired were all there to see Cuddlebuck do his one performance. And he came out, and he started by doing a new trick he had invented in retirement. He hadn't worked for 20 years. He invented a trick, and he did this new trick, which I can't even begin to describe. But I saw the look on the faces of all these accomplished, great magicians going, "I'm not sure how he did that."
Oh.
And then he did the X-ray eye trick, and it takes about 10-15 minutes of putting. They put these coins over his eyes. They put dough over that. They wrapped his head. They put another layer of this. He had about 15 layers of stuff on his head.
Wow.
Masking his eyes, and then he had a blackboard there. He would invite various people to come down, and they would write on the blackboard, and he would duplicate what they wrote. And it reminded me, I have this strange ability to forge handwriting. I can do people's handwriting just like they can. And he was doing the same thing, but he was blindfolded.
Wow.
And Sherry went down and did a drawing, and he replicated her drawing exactly. And it was just an amazing act. It was a trick, of course, but it was a very amazing trick. And afterwards, everybody's mobbed around him and congratulating him and having their picture taken with him. It's a legend of magic. So I forced my way up there, and I said to him, "Mr. Bucks," whatever you call, what do you call Cuddlebuck, right? "When was the last time you did your act on television?" And he said, 1964. I forget what he said. This was 1981.
Okay.
And I was writing That's Incredible for ABC at the time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And when I saw Richard Turner at the castle a couple months earlier, I put him on That's Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Cuddlebuck, would you like to do your act on network television? And he said, really? And he said, I'm not sure I was ever on color TV.
Oh.
And I said, the show is called That's Incredible. He was in town. We could tape it this Friday if you could stay a couple more days over. And he says, yes, I want to do this. So I went in the next day and I told the producer about it. I said, trust me, let's put him on the air. And they said, fine. And they had the talent coordinator called. And the castle said, we told him where he was staying. They couldn't reach him. And Thursday, we had to cancel off. We couldn't reach the guy.
Oh.
And the talent coordinator came in and said, we can't reach him. We got to dump him from the schedule. I'm sorry.
Oh.
We can't do it. And then an hour later, she came in and said, I know why we couldn't reach him. And his obit was in the Hollywood Reporter.
Oh.
He had died Tuesday night.
Oh, that's too bad.
But so excited. He passed away
excited, yes.
Because he was going to be on national
yeah.
television.
So
that's kind of a beautiful story in a way. It's tragic.
Yeah, it's tragic.
But it's still, I mean, you'd like to think that he was on a high after performing, you know,
yes.
when he passed away. Yeah. But still, the potential, because what if it had gone bad, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The potential of, you know, that's a really nice thing to mm-hmm. carry you onto your next journey, I suppose.
Yeah.
That is creepy, though. You're right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who was it you were talking about that passed away on stage? Was it you guys that were telling me the
so
story?
So many of them.
Yeah, but I mean, like, literally came
Dick
out.
Dick Shawn?
Was it? Yes. Will you tell that story?
Oh, well, I wasn't there.
I just
there
ruined
for
it.
Yeah, well, no. Dick Shawn, people remember Dick Shawn. Dick Shawn was in two of the funniest movies ever made. It's A Mad, 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 Mad World.
That's
and
right.
The Producers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He played Hitler in the latter.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very crazy, silly man. And he had an act he did that played the Cannon Theater in Beverly Hills and other places for years called The Second Greatest Entertainer of the Whole Wide World. It was called something like that.
That's funny.
And it was the most amazing evening of the theater I ever saw in a small theater, not a musical, but just one guy on stage for 2.5 hours. And at one point, when you came into the theater, the stage was covered with old crumpled newspapers. And you didn't know, unless you had seen the show before, I went to see it twice, that Dick Shawn was under the newspapers. And when the show started, he emerged from underneath them. He was on the stage before you came into the theater.
Oh, my gosh.
And he would stay on the stage the entire show. He never left the stage. During intermission, he would lie down on the stage and sometimes feign a heart attack. And he would just lie on the stage and rest during intermission while you were going in and out for popcorn or use the restroom.
Oh,
and then at the top of Act Two, he would leap up and do this incredibly amazing, energetic act. And one night he was, I think it was in San Diego, he was doing this, and
mm-hmm.
he was just laying there. And the second act started, he just continued to lay there. And the second act, and the audience started laughing because it's like, how long is he going to keep this up? And finally, the stage manager, who I think somebody told me was Sean's son, came out to see what was wrong, and the audience laughed. They thought the stage manager was part of the bit, and Mr. Shawn had passed away. He'd had a heart attack, and the audience never believed it. The audience apparently left there that evening. They said, sorry, the show is over. He's going, he's died. You can have to go home. And the audience sat there going, hey, that's a good one. Okay, what's next? And they said, no, he's actually dead. Leave. And they went, okay, it's pushing this joke way too far. And I thought to myself, years later, I thought, boy, would Andy Kaufman have envied that exit?
Yes, absolutely.
That's very funny. Yeah. You know, Andy Kaufman reminds me of Wally Wingert. Because
he's got
house,
the suit. Yeah.
Have you ever been to Wally's house? Mark?
Yes. Well, do you know the connection between Andy and Wally Wingert?
No.
Well, for those who don't know, Wally Wingert is a voice actor.
Very talented voice actor.
He is Jay Leno's announcer, and he's
John.
The voice of John on the Garfield show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If Wally shaves off the beard and that long hair and the mustache, he looks like Andy Kaufman.
I see that. I can see that. Thinking about
Andy
it.
Came to town one, when Andy first came to town, he was an Andy Kaufman worshiper, and he had actually managed to get replicas of Andy Kaufman costumes that Andy Kaufman traditionally wore. I think later on he got some actual Andy Kaufman.
He did.
Outfits.
They're on display in his house.
Yeah.
But at this time he had great replicas.
Yeah.
Tony Clifton and other things like that. So he read in the breakdowns one day that E! Was looking for someone to play Andy Kaufman for the E! True Hollywood Story of Andy Kaufman. So he shaved off the beard and the mustache, trimmed his hair short, put on the outfit, went to the audition. And when he walked in, the other guys who were going to audition went, hell with it, and left. And Andy got the part. And Wally played Andy in the E! True Hollywood Story, in the recreations of Andy's life.
Thank you very much.
So now Wally, lets the beard grow back, lets the hair grow back. 10 weeks later, there's a break. He gets agent sends him on a voiceover audition. He walks in and he finds out they're looking for someone to narrate the episode of the E! True Hollywood Story about Andy Kaufman.
Oh, my God.
And they hired him without realizing it was the guy in the episode. So he narrated it, and he played the character. And it wasn't until he was doing the narration that he's sitting there, you know, he's doing the narration, and he kept saying, hey, that guy's great. Hey, that guy's fabulous. Then he finally told him, by the way, that's me. So the credits, if you watch the thing, the credits say Wally Winger playing Andy Kaufman. The credits, you know, narrator Wally Winger.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That wily little minx.
I've got a trivia question running around in my brain since we're talking about Dick Shawn. There's a third great role he has that comes up every year. He played the Snow Miser in Year Without of Santa Claus.
Mark knew exactly what you were talking about, because as soon as you said the third great role comes up every year, Mark started nodding immediately.
He was the original. He was going to, Dick Shawn was originally signed to play Little Abner in the Broadway show. And they found Peter Palmer and reneged on their deal with Dick Shawn.
Oh, no.
And Dick Shawn sent a letter to Peter Palmer after opening night and said, congratulations, you're much better in the role than I would have been. And he probably was.
Well, that's very gracious.
And yeah, he was a very strange man. I never knew him, but everybody I know who knew him said he was completely out of his mind.
Okay.
And they loved him for that.
I'm down with that.
And,
that's cool.
And if you'd like sometime, I will show you a video of that one-man show he did.
I would love to see it. I was going to ask you to tell me all about it. Yeah.
I got one from his daughter on the condition I not duplicate it, so don't any of my other friends ask to have copies of it.
Yeah, nobody can have it, but Mark will show it to us.
Yes.
Let's see. But my trivia question was, he did Snow Miser. Heat Miser was somebody who did a lot of cartoon voices.
George S. Irving.
I couldn't remember the name, and it was on the tip of my mind. Because he also did voices on Tennessee Tuxedo and all the New York cartoons.
He did all those Twinkles the Elephant cartoons.
That's right.
George S. Irving is still playing in theater. He's been on Broadway a lot. He's one of those character actors who's always working his whole life. And
they did a new Miser Brothers special 2 years ago, and he did the voice again.
Yeah, he still works. He's like 94, and he's still working.
Yeah.
That is fabulous. Mm-hmm. Okay, more magic. Who else do you like? I know you like smart magic, but who are some of your favorite magicians? Mark, for those of you at home that don't know, wrote an episode with Sergio of The Spirit. And Mark dropped a couple of names, and he said he liked Johnny Ace Palmer.
Yes, Johnny Ace Palmer.
Now, who else?
Well, I put in names of different people. I put in the name of somebody named Misty Lee. We actually made her a character in the episode.
Yeah.
I mentioned the Pendragons, and I put Whit Hayden in, and I put I just put guys I'd seen at the castle recently, pretty much.
Yeah.
There's certain magicians you just have to admire, like Lance Burton or David. I saw David Copperfield. He's as good as they say he is. Lance Burton, I just love Lance Burton. Lance had a show at the Hacienda for several years that I went to see many, many times. At first, I went to see it because he was wonderful. Then I started dating one of his dancers, and
So
I was going to see the show for her, it was like the show was done for a budget of about $8. The Hacienda Hotel, I'll tell you a quick story here. One time I took Len Wein and Marv Wolfman to Vegas. We all went to Vegas. Went to the Consumer Electronics Show.
Okay.
And I said to the guys, I want to go to the Hacienda Hotel and see the Minsky's Burlesque Review starring Dexter Maitland and Irv Benson. And Len and Marv said, who the hell are Dexter Maitland and Irv Benson? I said, just trust me. At the time, Dexter Maitland was the last surviving straight man from Minsky's Burlesque, and Irv Benson was the last surviving comedian.
Oh,
now,
wow.
Now, at this moment, Irv Benson is the last surviving comedian. Dexter has passed.
Oh.
But Irv Benson is still out there, and he's not working anymore. He's retired, but he's still alive. And these two guys, people will remember Dexter Maitland. He was the guy in the movie The Night They Read at Minsky's who sang Take 10 Terrific Girls, the blonde, blonde guy.
Yep.
He was all throughout that movie.
Yeah.
And he was an honest-to-God burlesque straight man who had, for years, had been the guy in all these burlesque reviews done over the years. He was in Minsky's Burlesque, and then there were all these subsequent revivals and touring companies recreating burlesque in the 50s, and he was in all of them. And he and Irv Benson got up there. The first time I saw them was in Reno, with Sherry Flennigan again. Sherry and Flennigan, I took Sherry to Reno, and we went to see them doing the Penthouse Pet Review at the Sahara Hotel, starring Dexter Maitland, Irv Benson, and Sandler and Young.
Wow.
Sandler
wow.
and Young were in this
wow.
thing.
Wow.
And we saw, you know, it was the penthouse girls walking around taking their clothes off, and it was Dexter Maitland and Irv Benson doing old Merminsky's routines. Wow. That same kind of old pro, guys who've done it for years, can get every laugh that's there. And then they were at the Hacienda for a couple years doing that. And I would go and I'd hang out backstage with Dexter and Irv and ask them questions about Minsky's burlesque and stuff like that. And then that show closed, finally, after it had been there for, you know, 12 years, something like that. It finally closed. And it was the cheap, shoddy, shabby show. And it was replaced by Lance Burton's first solo show he did, which I think he put together for about $11. And he used the old Minsky's burlesque sets. He put a coat of paint on the old set pieces and used them in his show.
Oh, wow.
And he put together this wonderful, I think it was $15 admission. And he worked his ass off on it, and he was just very, it was a magic show where the magician was doing the magic. You of all people know what I'm talking about by this.
I do.
But like you go to if you'd gone to see Siegfried and Roy, which I did once, they did no magic. The props did the magic.
That's
the technical
true.
Effect
right.
did the magic. Any two guys could go up there who, if their accents were really bad enough, they could have filled in for Siegfried and Roy, because they didn't do anything. They just pointed at the boxes, and the boxes did the tricks. Mm-hmm. And they pointed at it was all special effects. But Lance Burton was out there doing every trick himself. It was all his own manipulation, his own sleight of hand, his own misdirection, his own ingenuity. And the ingenuity to do a full-scale Vegas-quality show with no money was brilliant. And that was my favorite magic show that I ever saw, that Lance Burton show.
That was our first date.
And then later he moved to the Monte Carlo,
yeah.
And the show was bigger, fancier, more expensive. I didn't like it quite as much, because he wasn't doing as much of the magic as he was. Because to make it bigger, they had to, you know, go to things where there were hydraulics and hidden, you know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. But they built that theater for him.
They built that theater for him.
Think,
and they put all the... They built it like a Disneyland ride to run all those different effects. And but I liked Lance Burton at the Hacienda. It was one of the greatest magic. I saw that thing. I must have seen it... 15 times over the years. A couple occasionally from the wings. But
very nice.
Yeah, and it was just a great show.
Well, you were talking about admiring skill before, and that opening act that he does, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been doing it for how long? And it is poetry.
Yeah.
It is truly poetry. There's one other act that I think comes close to it skill-wise, and that's Penn & Teller's version of Misdirection. When they talk about the seven different levels. You don't like it?
I've seen them do that so many times, I'm sick of it.
See, I've only seen it once.
I don't get sick of Lance's making the doves appear. It's the same thing we talked about earlier. That poetry of some guy who knows how to do it so well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's just wonderful. You know, there's a lot of good magicians around, and sometimes you see these guys who have these incredible acts of close-up. Mm-hmm. And you kind of think to yourself, wow, this guy is fabulous. What can he ever do to make money with this?
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a lot of, you know, I mean, a Lance Burton can get his own showroom and a multi-million dollar contract. A guy who's going, pick a card, you know, what's he going to do? He's going to play small rooms, cruise ships, you know, Richard Turner. You can't be better at card manipulation than him.
Right.
He's not getting million-dollar contracts.
No.
I guess you just have to love the art form and do it. It's the same with anybody who's got a novelty that they do or a unique act. Like, you know, ventriloquism, puppetry. People have said, you know, do we need puppets now that we have, you know, CGI that can do anything? It can imitate life in any particular way. And, you know, a guy sitting with a puppet on it, you know, but it's all a craft. I mean, Ron Lucas is terrific. You know?
Yeah, we saw Ron Lucas, the ventriloquist at the castle a week or two ago, and he was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
He's a first-class guy. I spent a couple of days in Laughlin with Ron, hanging out with him.
Laughlin,
Nevada.
Mm-hmm. What a random place to
Have you ever
be.
Been to Laughlin?
No.
Well, Laughlin is like Las Vegas for really, really old people and their parents.
Awesome.
and for a while I was going to hide out from the telephone and work.
Uh-huh.
I would go to Laughlin. Back when there were flights to Laughlin. You can't fly to Laughlin anymore from LAX.
Wow.
You have to fly to Phoenix and change planes. It's impossible. Mm. There used to be a direct flight, now there isn't. So I go to Laughlin, and It was kind of interesting because at the Flamingo Hilton in Laughlin, you could get a room for $14 a night, a real honest-to-God good hotel room. And you could go to the buffet, and the buffet was $5. And I thought to myself, you know, if you were broke, if you were homeless and broke, you could stay for, let's say you ate two buffets a day. You went to the buffet twice a day. That's all the food you can eat. That's more food than anybody ever want. Mm-hmm. And you stayed at the room for $14. So basically, you could live for $24 a day in Laughlin, and you could have maid service, your own room, free TV with HBO, and all the food you can eat for $24 a day.
Why do we live here?
We're moving.
Let's go.
Do they take docs?
The prices have gone up since then.
Oh, okay.
But I thought that was, you know, that's...
I bet there are guys who live like that, you know? You know? People who just, you know, look out for deals,
yeah,
like that.
So you could live there for you know. So I go to Laughlin and just stay there away from everything. And every time I was in Laughlin, the amazing Kreskin was playing there, and it was $5 admission.
Wow.
Oh.
And there was always I never went to see him. There was always a phone number to call for reservations. I thought to myself, if he's any good, he'll know I'm coming. You saw a weird accident. In Laughlin, I met Breck Wall. You know who Breck Wall was?
No.
Breck Wall was a guy who toured for years and years and years in a show called Bottoms Up, the worst show to ever tour Vegas and casinos and Laughlin.
What was that show?
It was like a naughty laugh-in. It was as naughty as they could be, which wasn't that naughty.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a review of. Like a burlesque review, but it wasn't burlesque. It was just sketches. It kept changing. He kept writing new stuff. And Breck Wall was the star of it. And he gained notoriety because when Jack Ruby shot John F. Kennedy, Breck Wall was working for him. He was a nightclub. And Breck Wall is in the Warren Commission.
Wow.
He became famous as the friend of Jack Ruby's who testified. And I was always interested in the Kennedy assassination, and I was always interested in Vegas and show business. And I got to meet a guy who qualified in both categories.
Yeah, you did.
Yes. Wow. And the other great thing in Laughlin one time, I was playing at this hotel, and they had a thing called Jukebox Giants.
Okay.
And they would bring in, it was an oldies show, and the show was there constantly, but the acts would change every week or two. Tiny Tim, when he died, was playing in Jukebox Giants at the Flamingo in Laughlin. So they would have they'd bring in two or three acts that had hit records, and mostly these were one-hit wonder guys. And they had like Keith come in. Remember Keith? He had one hit song, 98.6. The song was called 98.6.
Oh my gosh.
And so Keith would come out and he'd sing 98.6, and everybody would cheer. And then he would, you know, sing another song, and nobody would care about that. And then he'd come back and sing 98.6 again, and everybody would cheer again. And then he'd come out for the finale. He'd do 98.6 for the third time, and he'd you know, he'd sing. He basically would sing a medley of his hit.
Oh yeah.
So I met the booker, the guy who booked this thing. And he's on his little cramped office, and he's on the phone to agents and things like that. And there was a group called the Yellow Balloon that had one hit in the 60s, and the song was called Yellow Balloon.
Oh,
there you go.
Okay? Yellow Balloon had one hit. The flip side of Yellow Balloon was Yellow Balloon played backwards.
No, it wasn't.
All right? I am not making this up.
Oh yeah. My gosh.
All right?
That's awesome.
Okay, so usually a one-hit wonder has two songs.
Yes.
Because records have two.
Yeah.
They were a one-hit wonder with one song.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm in the office with this manager, the guy who books the show, and somebody phones him, an agent, and he says, I got the perfect act for your show. I got Yellow Balloon. And the booker says to the fellow, I had Yellow Balloon here 6 months ago. And he says, oh no, that version has the drummer. I've got the second guitar in my old. There were two Yellow Balloon bands touring.
Oh, oh
man.
God.
There are two, one hit, there were two different
two
groups going around passing themselves off as Yellow Balloon.
Well, two Gallaghers.
Yeah.
Yeah. You remember that movie that Tom Hanks did,
The Thing You Do.
The Thing You Did by the group called The Wonders.
That song is still stuck in my head.
Yeah, yeah. And it was about this group in the '60s, at the Beatles era, that had that one hit. Mm-hmm. And if Tom Hanks, and I'm sure, I know he listens to your podcast all the time.
Yeah.
Of course
he does.
The
Who's movie, our guest next week?
What he's got to do is he's got to do a movie next, in a couple of years, where he gets the same actors back, set in the present day, and what's happened is that those guys have gone out, and two of them became engineers, or they went into life insurance, and two of them, one of them couldn't get a job, so he went out and hired, got three other guys, and he went out as the Wonders.
Yes.
And then somebody else, one of the other guys, goes out as, finds three friends, and he goes out as the Wonders, you know, and they, of course, and they play different places where they play with, you know, the Platters, where one guy in the act used to be part of a, of an act that had one of the guys in the original Platters.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just, you know, you go around and at one point there was an act in Vegas. There was a show that was in Vegas. It was the Coasters, the Drifters, the Platters. And it was the same guys. They just kept coming out.
Wow.
Awesome.
One of the funnier elements, and I don't know how it plays in the movie, but funnier elements I've seen in the upcoming Muppet movie is that apparently it deals with the Muppets getting back together after being separated for a while. And apparently Fozzie Bear is working in Reno with a group called the Moopets, who are one-offs of each of the Muppets.
But you see, what happens would be like the Wonders, let's say.
Yeah.
One of the guys was, I guess, three friends, and they go out and they tour the Wonders. And then that guy retires, and somebody else takes his place.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, it's like the story of George Washington's axe.
Exactly.
They replaced the blade four times and the handle six times, but it's still George Washington's axe. You know. And so I remember that. I used to go to see Jukebox Giants in Laughlin. It was wonderful. Anyways, that's
fabulous. No, you used to write.
Okay, I think one more Laughlin story.
Oh, dude, Laughlin, dude. Yes, they're
fabulous. Remember, I guess this was like mid-80s, they changed the money. The new 20s came out with the larger picture
of
Andrew Jackson on, and the new 5s, the larger picture of Lincoln.
Which still look weird to me.
I'm in Laughlin, and I was playing a little blackjack at the time. So I go to the automated teller to get out $300 to go play blackjack with. Mm-hmm. And it spits out in 20s, these Andrew Jackson 20s. The first time I had seen them. Mm. They were the first time anybody in Laughlin had seen them. They had just brought them in that day and loaded them into the change machines, into the ATMs.
Oh, no.
And I looked at these things, and I had heard that the money was being changed. And I looked at this thing, and I go, oh, wow, that's interesting. So So I go to the blackjack table, and I give the lady the $300 to turn into chips. And she lays the money out, and she starts looking at the money, going, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. And she calls the pit boss over, and she shows him the money, and he has never seen it before either. And I realize what they're thinking is, they're thinking, A, it's counterfeit. I have counterfeit all this money.
Really,
and
badly.
B, I decided to redesign the money while I was out.
And make it different.
Yes. You know. And of course, the bills are all spanking new and fresh. Yeah. They've never been touched by human hands before.
Because you just minted them and washed them at home.
And they start calling over the they stop all play, and they called over like the executives at the casino, and they're looking at this money and going, "Should we take it or not? We're not sure. We're not sure if it's real."
Gosh.
And I said, and I finally said, "It's real. That's the new money."
Yeah.
And they said, "Well, we've never seen this before. How do we know it's real?"
Well,
and I said,
"Your ATM."
I said, "Go over to your ATM and get make a withdrawal. They'll give you more of it."
Yeah.
And I said to them, "Look at the logic of this. If I were counterfeiting money, I wouldn't redesign it." And they finally went like, okay, but this had better be real money.
And in the time that it took them to all come over and investigate your table, I wonder how much money they lost off of all the tables around you.
2 hours later, everybody in the casino was playing with that money.
Of course.
I was just the first one they'd ever seen with that money.
Yeah.
I had the same reaction when the Susan B. Anthony dollar came out. I was in New York.
Wait a minute.
And he was eating at the Carnegie Deli, which was cash only. And I had in my
That's
pocket.
That's what I'm going to be for Halloween. The Carnegie Deli pickle.
Oh, there you go.
All right. Anyway, go ahead.
Hey,
I'm sorry.
Look what he's doing.
Mark just looked at me. He's looking at me like I'm a leper. Anyway, go ahead.
So what happened was I was at the Carnegie Deli. I'd had breakfast, and I had a handful of Susan B. Anthony dollars, and I also had some regular dollars. But I thought, I think I'll get rid of the coin. So I just paid my check, you know. And I took it up and I put it on the counter and the guy's kind of looking at it and I walk out. The counterman runs out after me. He goes, hey, you didn't pay. And I said, yes, I did. I put down these dollars. He goes, I don't know what this is. What is this? And I said, that's a Susan B. Anthony dollar. They're brand new. And he goes, oh, no, you got to pay real money.
Not this Monopoly stuff.
Yeah, so luckily I took the money back and I gave him the, you know, like a, I guess I had a five in my other pocket. And I said, but that is real money. And his attitude was like, yeah, you try and con me out of a free sandwich, you know. He was actually hostile. It's like the guy in Radio Days running down the street with a butcher knife. You know, like,
we were just watching Radio Days. That scene where he quotes the Lone Ranger to his rabbi. He says, what kind of a bringing is this? I just watch it over and over and over. And I just, watching Seth Green get smacked by his rabbi, nothing brings me greater
Kenneth
joy.
Mars playing a rabbi, nonetheless.
Oh, really?
Kenneth Mars smacking like 12-year-old.
Young Frankenstein.
What? Yeah, yeah. Smacking the crap out of Seth Green.
It's and then they all start beating him because he's not getting enough. You know, the father starts beating him and the mom says, I'll beat him because you're too lenient. And then the rabbi's hitting and the father's hitting. And then finally the rabbi says, enough, you'll hurt the boy. Oh, God,
then
I love
Seth
it.
Is probably like this on the set, like, oh.
Let's do another take. Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Woody.
Okay, so now you've written for magicians too.
A little bit, yes.
Yes, who?
I wrote for Don Allen, a old magician. I wrote for... I read for. I haven't written that much for magicians, I don't think. I can't think of what else I wrote for.
Okay.
I wrote for Don. That's kind of it, sort of.
Did you ever write anything for Ron Lucas?
Not for Ron Lucas, no. Mm-hmm. Gave him a couple of jokes. But no, Ron's, you know, these guys, they have an act. They don't need material. They've got tons of it. Ron plays all over the world in his act. And he's brilliant. I tell these guys, you just only want to offer them material because they're so clever on their own.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, Frank Ferrante is the very first name that comes to mind, you know, to watch him case the audience and just circle through the crowd and improvise. It is remarkable, but you are just such a tremendous writer. So, let's see, there was another magic question I wanted to ask you. Oh, it'll come back.
What surgery are you up to?
I have no idea.
Draw something.
We're doing a story for a Dark Horse anthology, and we're finishing up Gru Meets Conan.
Oh, I can't wait.
And Serge is doing his own book without me, which it's the same premise. Mark doesn't get paid, but I don't have to actually do work in it. So.
I like those last few issues of Bunnies he's been doing that you guys have appeared in characters.
I haven't seen the last one or two. I know I'm in them, but I haven't seen them.
Oh, we have an issue of the Ojai Valley magazine. Sergio's on the cover. We have a copy for you. In
it. Oh, Sergio's everywhere. He's ubiquitous. Yeah. Years ago, Sergio had a paperback that came out called Viva Mad. It was the first Mad paperback.
I remember reading that on a plane when I was flying to Boston.
I had a copy of it, and he gave. When the first time I met him, he gave me a copy of an autograph. Yeah. And everybody I knew had a copy of the book autographed by Sergio. Mm-hmm. I would go to secondhand bookstores, and I'd see it on the shelf, and I'd look peek, and they were always autographed. Yeah.
He wandered into bookstores.
So one day, I'm standing with a friend of mine outside my house. This is where I lived with my parents back in the old house. And I was about 17, whatever. And I'm standing there talking to a friend of mine, and we were joking about how unautographed copies of Viva Mad are rarer than autographed copies. And we're waiting for my mailman to come and bring me the mail, and the mailman, so help me this is true, the mailman walks up and he says, hey, you're kind of into cartoons, right, aren't you? And I go, yeah, because he's delivered a lot of stuff to me, he recognizes it, and he says, I thought you got a bang out of this. And he pulls out a copy of Viva Mad, autographed to him, and inside is a caricature by Sergio of my mailman.
Awesome.
Sergio is everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. One time we were back in New York when I first got to know Sergio. I went to a 1970 comic convention at the what is now the Pennsylvania Hotel, and it was the Statler Hilton.
Okay.
And I think it hasn't been cleaned since it was the Statler Hilton.
Ew. Okay.
But Sergio was appearing on a Mad panel. The comic convention was in the penthouse. He was appearing on a Mad panel there. And there was this group called ACPA at the time. It was like an attempt to form a comic book writer and artist union.
Mm.
And they were having a meeting in a ballroom off the lobby downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And Sergio was on that panel at the same time he was on the Mad panel. And what happened was, It was very strange. He managed to be on both panels at the same time. And I went with him. They introduced him on the MAD panel. And John Putnam, who was the art director, was going to do his slideshow of MAD history. So Sergio took a bow, and then they dimmed the lights to show John's slideshow. And Sergio slipped out. I ran with him. He gets into the elevator, rides down 24 stories, and the entire elevator, he's doing autographing cartoons and comic strips for people. He runs out and walks into the comic book panel, and he's on this dais. He sits on this dais with Denny O'Neill and a bunch of other people, and they're talking about the future of the business and how they can improve working conditions for writers and artists. And at one point, Denny says, now we all know that guys who wrote new comic books, none of us are going to be able to afford a yacht. And everybody laughs because Sergio had just bought a yacht.
Oh, God.
And Sergio slinks under the table like a joke, and he goes under the table. He crawls out behind the curtain behind runs around the back. I run with him. He gets into the elevator. He goes up 24 stories, and he's doing autographs the entire way up. We go into the MAD ball where the MAD thing is. Just as the lights come up, and Sergio's leading the applause, and he goes, very good. And he starts answering questions about MAD and stuff like that. And somebody asks him, hey, Sergio, will you draw for us? Will you do some drawings? He says, wait, I will get my pens. And he runs out, and he goes downstairs 24 stories. And I go with him again, autographs all the way down. He goes back, he crawls under the table, the back of the curtain behind the dais, and comes up 8 minutes later, like he'd been under the table the entire time, and he answers the next question, and he goes back down under the table, crawls out of the back, and then goes upstairs. He managed to be on both panels at the same time, and nobody ever caught on that he was doing both. And you know, later that day, I actually ran to somebody who said, hey, did you see Sergio at the ACPA panel? No, I was up at the MAD panel. He was at the MAD panel. No, he was at the ACPA panel at 2 o'clock. No, he was at the MAD panel at 2 o'clock. And he were both right.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, he's your new favorite magician, I guess.
Yeah. I heard you talk about the book, but I mean, how did you... Sergio Aragonés is everybody's favorite magician. Yeah. There we go. You answered my question.
We had a comic book club when I was a kid. I was the president of it. And Sergio came to the club one time, was a guest speaker. One of our members found him in the phone book. The Life magazine ran
in the American phone book?
Yeah. Life magazine ran a photo of Sergio doing needlepoint. And it mentioned that he lived in the Beverly Hills.
Okay.
And one of our members looked up the Beverly Hills phone directory and found him and called him up and said, would you come to our comic club and give a speech? And he said, sure. And he came over.
And how old were you?
I was 16.
Okay. Wow. So you guys really were kids.
So 2 years later, 3 years later, no, 3 years later, I guess it was, I was working for Jack Kirby, and I met Sergio a couple times at comic type events. We didn't have any Comic Cons yet, but a couple of bookstores and things like that. I ran into a couple places. So in July 1970, my friend Steve Sherman and I, we were working for Jack Kirby, and we were working also for a company called Marvel Mania, which was doing the Marvel fan club stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
So we flew back to New York for the July 4th convention, we flew a week back early so we could go to the DC offices, the Marvel offices. So the first day there, we went to the DC offices, and I met all the comic book artists I never knew, all the editors. I had lunch with Julius Schwartz, first time I met him, and I met Neil Adams, and I met Joe Kubert, and I met, you know, it was like, for a guy who grew up on comics, this was like, my God, I'm meeting everybody whose work I ever admired.
Yeah.
The next day, we had an appointment with Stan Lee.
Wow.
At Marvel, because we were doing the Marvel fan club stuff. So we left the hotel, the Statler Hilton. Mm-hmm. We left the Statler Hilton. Just before we were about to leave, we had a 11 a.m. appointment with Stan. About 10:15, we were about to leave for it, and they called and said Stan has to bump the meeting to 3 o'clock. He's busy. So we said, okay, well, we got some time to kill. Let's walk over to Madison Avenue, just wander around. We walk over to Madison Avenue. We're just wandering up around, and all of a sudden I hear someone yell, "Mi amigos!" from across the street, and it was Sergio. And I don't know to this day how he recognized me. He only met me briefly one or two times before that. But he recognized me across the other side of Madison Avenue. We ran over to see him, and he said hello, and he goes, my friend's from Los Angeles. Good to see you here. And he's, where are you going? And we said, we're going to go meet Stan Lee. It's at 2 o'clock. Mm-hmm. He says, oh, you're going to visit the MAD offices? And it had not occurred to me to visit the offices of MAD Magazine when we were back there. And I said, no, we'd love to visit the offices of MAD Magazine. Where are they? And he says, right here. You're standing in front of them.
Oh, wow.
We were there in front of the MAD Magazine offices. Oh. So he takes us in. As we were Going in the building, I held the door for a man who was walking out with an art portfolio case. A little sad-eyed man. I said to Sergio, who's that? And he says, that's Wally Wood. And we went up to the Met offices and got the tour of the Met offices, met Al Feldstein and Angela Torres was up there that day. Mm-hmm. Antonio Porrias was up there. The whole Mad staff.
The usual gang of idiots, yeah.
And then we went at 2 o'clock. We went down the street and met Stan Lee and John Romita and Marie Severin and Herb Trimpe and Roy Thomas and all the people at the
the Marble Bullpen.
Yeah. And the next day we went over out to Times Square to a bad part of New York and spent the day with Steve Ditko.
Wow.
So in 3 days I'd met everybody who mattered in superhero adventure comics who I didn't already know. I already knew Jack Kirby by then, but everybody else. It was and then at the convention a couple days later I met all the freelancers who were in. And I got to spend time with Wally. And I hung out with Sergio at that convention mostly. Mm-hmm. We just hung around together and that's why we became friends.
Did you meet Steve Gerber at that time?
Not at that convention, no. I didn't meet Steve till years later.
Boy, you were close with him.
I met Steve. It's a very strange thing. Several people who worked for Marvel were telling me that Steve Gerber was criminally insane. They didn't mean ha-ha cute insane. They meant like Charles Manson insane.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And they said, he's going to be institutionalized. He's going to commit a murder. He's a crazy person. And I thought, wow, is that true?
Somebody tells me something like that, the first thing I want to do is meet him. Where is he?
So Sergio had this party. Sergio used to have this house up in the Hollywood Hills pre-divorce. It was a beautiful house. Mm. And after the San Diego Con one year, we all went up there to eat pizza and sit around the pool and talk. I started talking to this one guy. And we talked for like an hour. Mm-hmm. This guy with glasses, and I didn't know who he was. And after an hour, I was felt embarrassed to say, excuse me, he knew who I was.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But I didn't know who he was. If we'd been introduced, I hadn't caught his name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking to myself, who's this guy? And I didn't know how to say, excuse me, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to listen to what he's talking about, and I was thinking to myself, he says, I was writing The Defenders. I thought, Defenders. Who's written The Defenders? Well, Len wrote The Defenders. Mm-hmm. It isn't Len. I said, so Steve Gerber wrote The Defenders, but this couldn't be Steve Gerber. He's not, killing a live chicken. I mean, and finally he said, I was working at this Howard the Duck thing, and I go, this is Steve Gerber.
Yeah.
And we became buddies that night and became very good close friends.
Oh.
And of course, he was nothing like the description at all. That was a complete lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They just didn't get Howard the Duck.
People sometimes have these weird way of reading other people.
I remember reading his work when I was in high school, and his stories were like a revelation for me, like the Man Thing stories, because here you've got a character who is purely a reactive character. I mean, he like a mindless chunk of living swamp. So you can't really tell a story about him because there's no brain there, really. So he has to be kind of a force of nature. So all the stories were about people whose lives were suddenly affected by the Man Thing, or whose, the Man Thing was called to these people in these weird situations. So it was really like a great anthology series with this creature. And there was some character continuity, some sideline character, Howard the Duck, of course. But I read some of the stories, like in Giant Size Man Thing, and they were life-changing for me. I just thought the imagination that he had, and there was a bitterness to him, but there was also a tremendous skill, to the stories. I thought at that point I kind of got the potential of what a comic book writer could be, that it could be, the traditional stuff was a lot of fun, the superheroes and everything like that. But when I read, there was one story in Giant Size Man Thing I could read only once, because any other time I went back to read it, I just cried too much about a fat, bullied kid.
Oh.
Yeah, he was just a great writer, Steve, and probably too good for the comics he got assigned to. And he just had a very tough existence. I felt very bad about some of the stuff that happened to him.
Yeah.
Even before he got sick and we lost him. But he was just a good guy. We were very close friends, and he worked with me. When he got fired by Marvel, one of the editors at Marvel said, Steve, his work will never appear in another Marvel comic as long as I live. Mm. So I was doing the editing, the Hanna-Barbera comics that Marvel was publishing at the time. So I said, okay, Steve, you're writing an issue. and so we had a story written by Reg Everbest, which was Steve Gerber spelled inside out.
Nice.
Just to be ornery, just to say, oh yeah, what's this? Here's a Steve Gerber story in a Marvel comic.
Wow.
That's fabulous. All right. Well, I think we have carried on for long enough for one podcast. So let's bring it back next week because there is so much more that I want
yes,
to hear you say.
Next week. We'll be back next week.
So end of part two. Next week, part three.
No one is fooled by this.
I didn't even let you talk. Were you going to say something at the end of this?
Just that I'm actually going to go home and come back next week. We're not actually just editing episodes, a bunch of stuff into different episodes. And also you should know that during this podcast, any weird bodily sounds you hear are from a dog I have sitting on my lap at the moment.
Yeah.
And he would like to say that, but actually Deuce and Bugsy are being watched by the trainer. So any weird
bodily sounds. He's snoring over his own stories.
Yeah.
I bet Frank Welker could do that. Snore over his own story.
Probably.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.